Thank you, Kelly. We were just reminiscing that it was just a few short years ago Kelly was working with us doing waterborne disease outbreak work at CDC, so I'm really excited to see your career moving forward. So I'm going to talk about waterborne disease outbreaks in the United States from 2009 to 2014, and I do want to acknowledge my co-authors, particularly Virginia Roberts, who I'm giving this talk on behalf of since she was not able to travel here. So when we talk about waterborne disease outbreaks, we're talking about an incident in which two or more epidemiologically linked persons experience a similar illness after exposure to the same water source or recreational water-associated chemicals volatilized into the air surrounding the water. And waterborne disease outbreak data, while they're important at the local and state level for responding to outbreaks and developing prevention, at the national level, they do a number of things, including supporting the Environmental Protection Agency and their efforts to develop drinking water regulations, providing guidance for recreational water policies and communication, including the healthy swimming promotion that CDC and states do, and the Model Aquatic Health Code. And if you think about water in the U.S., it is complex. We use water for, in addition to drinking, for bathing, for washing hands, for swimming, for fighting fires. We play in it. We use it to cool our buildings. We run it through complex plumbing systems and buildings. And because it's complex, it might not surprise you that the actual reporting of waterborne disease is somewhat complex as well. That there are many different types of water, and that includes drinking water, recreational water, non-drinking, non-recreational water, which we've termed environmental, and that environmental or other water might include water used for agricultural purposes, or as I think we'll hear in just a sneak peek here in this session, cooling towers, other uses of water beyond just drinking or recreation. And so the routes of water exposure can be either ingestion, inhalation, intranasal, or direct contact. And water can become contaminated with microbes, chemicals, toxins. And while when we receive data reported through outbreaks, it's always great to have water testing that demonstrates contamination or identifies the etiologic agent in the water. That's not necessary to include waterborne disease outbreak. Many times the epidemiologic evidence is sufficient to determine that it was a waterborne exposure. And as I mentioned before, volatilized chemicals in recreational water settings, such as chloramines, chlorine byproducts, are also included as outbreaks associated with water. So just a brief history of waterborne disease, national waterborne disease outbreak reporting. In 1971, CDC started collecting drinking water-associated outbreaks. In 1978, a recreational water was added. In 1999, occupational uses of water. And then it wasn't in 2001 that we actually added Legionnaire's disease. Prior to that time, we had Pontiac fever, other Legionellosis, but not until 2001 did we add Legionella. Since that time, we've gone back and retrospectively included outbreaks prior to 2001 of Legionnaire's disease if they were well documented and published. Starting in 2009, outbreak reporting was through the National Outbreak Reporting System, which also includes foodborne disease outbreaks, animal-associated outbreaks, and person-to-person outbreaks. And these data are normally published through CDC publications, including CDC reports, and since 1985 through the MMWR. So what data do we collect through NORS? We talked we discussed briefly, but it's the location, including the state, the time, including the year and the month, the magnitude, including number of people ill, hospitalized, and those who died, etiology, predominant illness, the type of water exposure, the venue, and the setting. And after data are reported to CDC, we go through a review process where we close out the data, and I know there are a number of you here that from the state perspective are involved in that process, and I know it's labor-intensive for us to go back and forth with you, but we do want to go through it in a comprehensive way with epidemiologists, our laboratory colleagues, environmental health, and folks from EPA who also help us review that. And part of that process is assigning a strength of evidence or a class to all outbreaks, and I'll come back to that and talk about that more in detail, because that's not a reflection of the value or the validity of that outbreak investigation, but it's a way for us to look at the data and assign a value of strength to it. So, big picture, outbreaks since 1971. In blue at the bottom is recreational outbreaks, which, as we discussed, began reporting in 1978, drinking water all the way back to 1971, and more recently in the environmental or unknown. And if we look more closely at these outbreaks by different type, which is normally the way we talk about this, there are a few things, and again, this is very much abbreviated, but as I mentioned, the drinking water data are used for national policy. And if you look, there are a few things I've noted on here, including in 1974, EPA put out the Safe Drinking Water Act, in 1989, the Surface Water Treatment Rule, and then in response to Cryptosporidium outbreaks, in 1998, there was interim enhanced surface water treatment rule, which required additional treatment to control for Cryptosporidium. And then subsequent to that, there's additional surface water treatment rules revisions to that. And then in 2006, the groundwater rule. And each of those have had an impact. If we had time, we'd delve into that and look at the impact of outbreak reporting on the implementation of these rules, and also the implementation of these rules, the impact they had on actual outbreaks. And I know we may not be able to say, we may be in an environment where it's not, we don't want to talk about regulation, but regulation actually is really important for controlling drinking water outbreaks. And then if we look at recreational water outbreaks, we've seen a dramatic increase, particularly in the last 15 years, in outbreaks in recreational water settings. This is no surprise to you. This is primarily driven by Cryptosporidium outbreaks, which is the chlorine-tolerant pathogen in treated recreational water. So it's definitely driven a lot of what we've tried to do in thinking about where do we need to go to control these outbreaks. And then though it's a much smaller, if you look at the scale here, this is a much smaller component of the outbreaks, there has been a definite increase in what we call environmental or non-drinking, non-recreational water outbreaks, the cooling towers, the other and continued other uses of water for irrigation, for backcountry water use, and I know that's going to be touched on later on in this session. So in summary, actually looking at more closely at the last 6 years, that was a big picture look, but in the last 6 years, the 432 outbreaks that have been reported from 2009 to 2014 include over 10,000 cases with an average size of 23 cases per outbreak. Some of these cases are very large, up to 1,300 cases. 841 persons were hospitalized, and 76 people were reported to have died from these outbreaks. And looking at it over years, there are a number of outbreaks reported each year, and also by state over the six-year period. There are differences in numbers reported by state, and I don't think this reflects the amount of outbreaks that occur in each state. Part of this might reflect the capacity within each state to detect, investigate, and report outbreaks, but there are a lot of reasons why there are different numbers of outbreaks reported. Outbreaks are seasonal, so you have more reporting, more onset of illness and outbreaks occurring in the summer, and if we look at that by the type of illness, it's no surprise to you that gastrointestinal, the diarrheal outbreaks occur markedly in the summer, whereas respiratory and the eye and skin outbreaks occur throughout the year. And now I'm going to present a few pie charts without apology or irony. And if you are scientifically opposed to pie charts, you may leave for the next couple minutes and then come back. But since we're talking about proportions of outbreaks, it might be the simplest way to look at them. For this six-year period, the biggest driver of number of outbreaks is Legionella, followed by the parasites, but also a continued bacterial non-Legionella outbreaks are important, along with chemicals and viruses. And then if you look at the type of water exposure, treated recreational water is nearly half of those outbreaks, although drinking water continues to be important with 25% of the outbreaks in that setting. And this is something looking at both drinking water and recreational water. If you looked at where do they occur, where do these outbreaks occur, the three big settings of occurrence are hotels or motels, hospitals or healthcare settings, and then parks or public outdoor areas. Certainly a number of other settings, and we've collapsed a number of them into that other category just because this pie would be too small, too many little pieces to digest, if it were. but there's certainly, these are the three drivers. If we're thinking about where do we want to focus efforts if we're both drinking and recreational water. But this really differs in setting by the pathogen. Legionella is really important in the hotel-motel setting and very important in healthcare setting, whereas you see things like parasites, which are much more important in park settings. And as well, the type of water exposure differs greatly. The treated recreational water in hotel-motels continues to be a big issue. In healthcare, no surprise that it's the drinking water, what comes in through that tap water that's really important, whereas in park settings, the untreated recreational water is nearly half of those outbreaks. I'm getting back to this issue, and I'll walk through a little bit of the strength of evidence. Since you're our state and local colleagues who work on this outbreak, I did want to spend a little bit of time talking about how we assign that strength of evidence and what do we do with it, and maybe it'll spur more conversation later. But as I mentioned, we review these outbreak reports and classify according to the strength of evidence, and that includes both that epidemiologic and laboratory evidence, but also the environmental health evidence that implicates water as a vehicle of transmission. And so, for example, if an outbreak is reported, you've recruited cases, you've recruited controls, you have an odds ratio and a p-value that would be sufficient to demonstrate an epi link, that's great epi evidence. Sometimes you have molecular epi evidence. The PFG pattern in the case matches the PFG pattern in the water, and that's also really good as epi evidence. And then environmental health. You know, we're able to do monitoring of either disinfectant residual or actually detect the pathogen in the water. That's also great evidence that we like to see. However, sometimes that's not possible. Sometimes the outbreak's only two or three people, which would take away the ability to do any valid statistical measures, or that it's a chemical release or a chloramine where it's very difficult to test the air quality. So those are difficult things that make those measures of either epi or environmental evidence very difficult. And so we assign these in four classes: provided inadequate, provided and limited, and not provided or inadequate, and those are class 1, 2, 3, and 4. However, I think it's very important for us to say this is not CDC's judgment or of the quality of the state or local investigation or reporting. We know you are able to do what you have are doing and making the decision based on what the facts at hand. And so this is not our judgment of that. But I do want to just present it just so you see what we see over the last 6 years, and there's a big difference. If just to orient you to this figure, and at the bottom in blue are the category of one, so that means the great epi, great environmental health data, and then two would be good, great epi data, but limited environmental data, and then three is not great, you don't have the epi data, and four is the epi and environment are lacking. And as you can see in Legionella, there's a lot of 3 and 4, as well as in the chemical toxin. And I think what that really reflects is a smaller outbreak size in those Legionella outbreaks, and in the chemical in the Legionella outbreaks. For the chemical and toxin outbreaks, I think a lot of what that describes is just the inability to do air sample testing in a lot of the cases, or not being able to detect that chemical because it was there very transiently. I wanted you to see the data because we compile it and we want to make sure we provide it back to you. So I'll wrap up here just to say that looking at the last 6 years of data, recreational water, particularly the outbreaks caused by Cryptosporidium, continues to be a big part of outbreak, waterborne disease outbreaks. Legionella is increasingly important and it's driving this increase in healthcare-associated outbreaks. Although I think as we see the increase in healthcare-associated outbreaks, it's important caveat to know that a lot of the water-associated healthcare outbreaks are not reflected in our national surveillance. And I think we're in the process of having that discussion and seeing which ones we could include and how that might change the picture of a waterborne disease in the U.S. The predominant water exposure type differs by setting. Any illness types are seasonal. You see more diarrheal outbreaks in the summer, but respiratory outbreaks occur throughout the year. And the top three settings that we see account for nearly half of the outbreaks: hotels, healthcare, and parks. So what are the implications? We've already mentioned the waterborne disease outbreak data. Are they evidence-based for a lot of effective prevention? Drinking water regulations from EPA, and the Model Aquatic Health Code, the CDC and state health departments are leading, Legionella's water management plans. All of these come out of looking at the data, seeing what the data say, and so they're very important, and we could not do this without state and local health departments continuing to detect, investigate, and report outbreaks. However, I think we should acknowledge the data are incomplete. You know, the limited CDC funding for water capacity does limit your ability to detect, investigate, and report outbreaks. We think state and local health departments do an amazing job with the capacity they have. But to move that forward, we really need more capacity. And there are challenges with complete reporting. Beyond that, and differ by type and setting of outbreak. And the outbreaks reports we know don't always include that complete investigation data on the epidemiology, the laboratory, or the environmental health. So I hope we can start a conversation about how we can work together to improve waterborne disease outbreak detection, investigation, and reporting. I'd like to thank all of you, our state and local and territorial health departments, including our waterborne disease coordinators, and all the co-authors on this abstract. So thank you. So I'll be glad to take questions.
I have one. John Neuberger, University of Kansas. So you have treated drinking water in hospitals are more noticeable for hospitals than some of the other sources. So I was wondering, how are they treated? What was missing?
That is a very good question. I think we get into the issue of when you talk about treated drinking water. We think of treated drinking water in public water systems as water that is safe for most people most of the time. However, when you think about, and this is my opinion, that when you think about hospital healthcare settings, there are places where tap water is not appropriate. People who are immune compromised, or if there is water exposure in places such as where you're preparing medications that will then be injected into sterile sites, that's a problem. Or if you have places where you're amplifying Legionella in your cooling system, and the people who have or already have respiratory issues are then exposed to it, that then becomes a real problem. So I think there, you're right, that is treated water. However, I think what the Legionella program and what's shown from the data have recognized that there's a need for hospitals to have a water management plan to think about the quality, even though the water that comes into their facility may be treated appropriately to drinking water standards, it may need additional treatment and management to make it safe for that healthcare environment.